Good evening, everyone. My name is Andrew Fracknoy. I'm the astronomy instructor here at Foothill College, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome everyone in the auditorium and everyone watching or listening on the web to the 10th annual Silicon Valley Astronomy Lectures, which start tonight. These lectures are designed to introduce some of the most interesting new results and ideas in the field of astronomy, and we invite noted astronomers and physicists from around the Bay Area and the country to update us six times during the school year. The lectures are sponsored by NASA and NASA's Ames Research Center, which is one of the premier research centers in the NASA circuit, by Foothill College, which is a community college here in Silicon Valley that offers both day and evening classes for students from age 16 to 80. And I actually have students from both those ranges in my evening class this quarter. So it's really a delight to see people from the community come up and take classes here. Our other co-sponsors are the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, a venerable organization that since 1889 has been doing what we do in these lectures, which is sharing the excitement of astronomical discovery with the world at large. And they have a number of educational programs which are outlined on the back of your program. And finally, the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, which is an organization devoted to the scientific investigation of life elsewhere. Now, for those of you who are here, I want to announce formally that we are also delighted to have working with us the local amateur astronomy organization called the Peninsula Astronomical Society. And they, as many of you know, also run the Foothill College Observatory, which has a new telescope donated to us by a generous donor and is open every clear Friday evening for viewing from 9 to 11, as well as Saturday morning for solar viewing, but that's not quite ready yet. And to show off the new telescope, they have graciously agreed to hold open the telescope tonight after the lecture. So if you're not busy and you want to walk over to our Krauss Center on the other side of campus, they will be glad to have a kind of star party and show off the telescope tonight. It was just clearing up as we were coming in. So as long as it remains clear, right, Sarah, that's the requirement. All right, so without further ado, let me then introduce our speaker. Our speaker is the author of a best-selling book about black holes called The Black Hole War, and it's the topic we've asked him to address tonight. Dr. Leonard Susskind is the Felix Bloch Professor of Theoretical Physics at Stanford University, and the author not only of The Black Hole War, but also The Cosmic Landscape, another introduction to the far-out frontiers of physics and astronomy. He's written many articles on recent developments in science and their meaning. He teaches a popular continuing studies course at Stanford on modern physics and has won the American Institute of Physics Science Writing Prize for an article explaining black holes in everyday language. His scientific research focuses on particle physics, quantum theory, and the nature of gravity. Small questions, right? But in fact, he is as well known for being a superb explainer of science. And so we have asked him tonight to explain a little bit about his ongoing intellectual battle with Stephen Hawking on the subject of some of the most mysterious objects in the universe, black holes. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a professional privilege for me to introduce Dr. Leonard Susskind.
Better? Okay. I can one-up you, Andrew. You're right, I do teach a class for the general public at Stanford. The name of the class, incidentally, I don't remember the precise real name of the class, but we all call it Quantum Mechanics for Old Farts. Anyway, I am not an astronomer. I've only once in my life looked through an astronomical telescope, so I may disappoint you. I don't have wonderful pictures of this or that galaxy and so forth. What I'm going to tell you about is a big controversy that took place in theoretical physics that had to do with black holes. Now, if you buy my book, and please buy my book, I get about $1.50 for every book you buy. If you buy my book and you open up to the central chapter, you'll find that the absolute central chapter, the center of the book, is called The Battle of Santa Barbara. The Battle of Santa Barbara was a physics conference. A bunch of theoretical physicists got together to battle out one of the central questions, one of the deep questions of theoretical physics. And I didn't know this when I wrote the book, but after I wrote the book, I discovered that one of my friends had taken a picture of the conference, and here it is. Let's see if I can remember who's who here. Here's Stephen Hawking over there. That's me. John Wheeler is over here. There's a fellow over here that's being stepped on by the horses. His name is Smolin. That's a joke, but maybe most of you don't get it. In any case, the black hole war was not really a war between people. It was certainly not a war between armies of people. It was a war between concepts. If you could photograph ghosts, this photograph would have a ghost of Einstein hovering over the whole thing. And the ghost of Einstein would be weeping. He would be weeping because the battle was between two of his children, two of his favorite children. It was a battle between the principles of general relativity, the so-called equivalence principle on the one hand, and on the other hand, quantum mechanics. These two theories clashed with each other from the very, very beginning. They were like angry enemies that simply couldn't reconcile each other. But the real battle broke out over the properties of black holes. Now, again, this is not a real photograph of a black hole. I wish it were. This is an artist's rendition. I suspect the background is quite real, but the black hole at the center is an artist's picture, but it's actually quite accurate. The boundary of the black hole, of course, is called the horizon. You can't see anything from inside the black hole. And, of course, all of these rings and distortions around the black hole are due to the fact that black holes bend light. So this is a picture of a black hole. This is a picture of an imaginary astronomical black hole. But the debate was not really over the properties of real astronomical black holes. It was over the principles of quantum mechanics, gravity, and how they relate to black holes. One of the deepest principles of physics, perhaps the deepest, in fact, in my view, I would have to say it is the deepest principle of physics, it's a quantum mechanical principle, is that information is never lost. Information comes in bits. I'll explain to you what that means. What does it mean for information to come in bits? You all know that your computer is full of bits. Well, here's a piece of information. I doubt that it's true. Maybe it is true. But it is a piece of information. King Canute had warts on his chin. Everybody will agree, either true or false, this is a piece of information. But how do you quantify the amount of information that's in this sentence? So let me quantify it for you. To quantify a bunch of information, what we do is reduce it to bits. Reducing it to bits is the same thing as reducing it to Morse code. Here's Morse code for King Canute had warts on his chin. And it consists of a bunch of dots and dashes. Information comes in bits. Bits are the same as dots and dashes. King Canute had warts on his chin is a 65-bit sentence, a 65-bit message. And that's what the quantity of information means. The number of bits or the number of dots and dashes that it takes to express a given thought, idea, message. That's how much information is in it. Now, as I said, one of the deepest principles of information, or of physics in general, is that information is never, ever lost. If you have some information in your computer, you can erase it. If you couldn't erase the information in your computer, it would get overloaded. But really, in fact, that information is not lost. What happens to it is it's ejected out of the computer in a little bit of heat. It is not lost information, it is scrambled information. A little bit of something gets ejected out into the atmosphere, scrambled around, hit by molecules and so forth. For all practical purposes, it's lost. But if you could examine every molecule in the room, every molecule of the computer, you would find that bit lurking someplace. So bits of information are never lost. As I said, that is one of the very, very deepest principles of physics. It goes way back. It actually goes back past quantum mechanics to classical mechanics. And it is sacrosanct, or always was sacrosanct. However, in 1976, Stephen Hawking put forward an idea that seemed to undermine that basic principle. The principle, the idea, had to do with black holes. Stephen was a great expert on black holes. You are not great experts on black holes. I'm only a medium expert on black holes, but I have my way of thinking of them, and I'm going to share with you my way of thinking about them. Imagine an infinite lake, a lake that's spread out in every direction, horizontally, forever and ever. And it's not a very deep lake, a meter deep, 1 meter deep. And in that lake lives fish. The fish communicate with each other. How do they communicate with each other? By sound. They're blind fish. They can't see. They communicate each other only by sound. And there's a rule. Whether it's a law of physics or a law of fish or a law of or a legalistic law, it doesn't matter to us very much. But the rule is no fish is allowed to swim faster than the speed of sound in the water. That means he's not allowed to swim faster through the water than the speed of sound. It could be a law of nature, as I said, or it could just be a law of fish. Well, this lake is a rather dangerous lake. And the reason it's dangerous is because right at the center of it is a drain hole. And the drain hole empties out underneath into a cave. And in that cave is very sharp rocks. Anything that gets sucked into the drain is doomed, is dead if it gets sucked into the drain. And what makes that drain hole so very, very dangerous is that at some point, at some distance away from the drain hole, the inflow of water is moving faster relative to the ground than the speed of sound. What that means is that any fish that passes that point, let's call it the point of no return, any fish that passes the point of no return has no chance of getting out. He can't outswim the current. The current is moving faster toward the center than he can swim. He's lost. He's doomed. Nothing yet has happened to him. He's floated freely past the point of no return, may not even realize it. Everything else is flowing with him. The dirt, the sand, whatever it is flowing along with him, has no concept that he has passed the point of no return, and yet he is doomed. Not yet dead, but doomed. He can try to shout to his friends. He can say, save me, save me. But even his sound waves can't escape because the water is moving faster than the speed of sound. Even they get pulled down into the drain. Well, this is a model of a black hole, and it's a rather accurate model of a black hole. Down at the center is the singularity of the black hole, the dangerous, dangerous place, which as you approach it, you will be crushed, squeezed, stretched, turned into whatever. The horizon of the black hole appears at first sight to be completely innocuous, non-dangerous in itself. You just float freely past it. The point of no return, I called it the horizon, that's what it is. The point of no return is called the horizon of the black hole. Nothing, including sound, or in the case of a real black hole, light, or anything else can escape from the black hole. That's really all you need to know about a black hole. That its horizon is a point of no return, and the singularity at the center is a very dangerous place. That's one picture of a black hole. Here's another picture showing the same thing. It's just another form of describing a black hole as a curvature in space.
Here's a fish. If that fish accidentally passes the point of no return, for some reason I've always called that fish Alice. Alice and her bits, everything about Alice, everything that makes Alice Alice, all the bits of information in her DNA and everything else are lost to the outside world. Apparently, bits of information can be lost, and they get lost by falling into a black hole. Or so Stephen Hawking said. To make things even more confusing, Hawking had discovered that black holes evaporate. Alice falls into the black hole, and now you wait, and the black hole evaporates. How does it evaporate? It gives off heat and light. It gives off photons. As it gives off photons, the energy of the photons is carried away, and the black hole shrinks. It shrinks because it's losing energy. Very, very much like a puddle of water out in the sun. As it evaporates, it shrinks, and it shrinks, and it shrinks, until there's nothing left. But where is Alice? What happened to her bits? They're gone. They fell behind the horizon. They couldn't get out because they can't exceed the speed of light. Or so said Stephen Hawking. And so in saying so, he basically announced a violation of the most sacred principle of physics: information is never lost. Well, was it really that simple? Some of us didn't think so. That was, in fact, the origin of the Black Hole War. The Black Hole War was a controversy involving Stephen, who said, yes, information is lost when it falls into black holes, and myself, and a physicist by the name of Gerard Etouft, a very, very famous physicist, incidentally, one of the to most physicists, incidentally, to most theoretical physicists, Gerard Etouft is number one. He is the great physicist of my generation. We said, no, that's too easy to say that information is lost. You're undermining something too deep, too fundamental. It can't be true. But we couldn't understand what was wrong with what Stephen was saying. If something falls into a black hole, it can't get out. If it can't get out, it's lost. If the black hole evaporates, it's gone. We didn't understand what was wrong with what he was saying, but we were sure he was wrong. That was the origin of the Black Hole War. All right, so let me tell you now a little bit more about what was learned about black holes since around the early 1970s. A little bit before Stephen made his claim. Let me start with the observation of a physicist whose name is Jacob Bekenstein. Again, a very famous Israeli physicist. In 1972, Jacob Bekenstein was a graduate student, a graduate student at Princeton. And he discovered something very, very remarkable about black holes. He didn't discover it by doing an observation. He didn't discover it by doing an experiment. He did it by doing a thought experiment, and here was his thought experiment. He began with the idea of entropy. What is entropy? Well, entropy was something that was first discovered and first talked about by steam engineers. It had to do with the quality of a given amount of energy. Is it useful energy? Is it not useful energy? Not useful energy is called heat. You can't do much with heat. Well, sometimes you can, but heat is harder to do things with than mechanical energy, and a measure of how useless energy is was called entropy. It's a measure of confusion, how confusing the little constituents which carry the energy are. If there are lots of molecules moving around in all sorts of crazy directions, there's lots of entropy. If all the molecules are moving together, there's only a little bit of entropy. Entropy had to do with steam engines. What could it possibly have to do with black holes? Well, the connection with black holes was a principle, namely the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics said entropy always increases. You cannot decrease the amount of confusion in the universe. You may be able to decrease the amount of confusion in one place, but it will always show up someplace else. And here was the puzzle that Bekenstein addressed. He said, let me tell you a little more about entropy. There's another idea of what entropy is. If I were to take a bathtub full of water, We would all agree, anybody who knows anything about water and about thermodynamics, that there's lots and lots of entropy in that water. What is that entropy? That entropy is the same as hidden information. When you look at that bathtub full of water, you don't see much. You see the amount of water, you see the temperature of the water, that's about all. But there's an enormous amount of information in that bathtub, and that information is stored in the position and velocity of every single molecule. It's there if only we had the patience to detect it and to count every molecule. That information, those bits of information, would be there. Another way of thinking about entropy is that it's hidden information. Information which is hidden because it's in too many degrees of freedom, too small, too mixed up, and too difficult to get at. Then it's called entropy. The principle of physics, the second law of thermodynamics, said that entropy always increases. But Bekenstein said, wait a minute. Supposing I take a bunch of entropy and I allow it to fall into a black hole. After it's fallen into the black hole, the black hole increases its size a little bit, but the entropy is gone. The steam engine that carried the entropy is gone. All we have left is the black hole. Entropy has disappeared. Bekenstein said, no, there's something wrong with this. He said, what's wrong with it is black holes must have entropy. When the black hole gets a little bit bigger, when it swallows the entropy, it gets a little bit bigger. It must be that somehow bigger black holes have more entropy, more hidden information in them than smaller black holes. So when we're going to count the entropy of the world, we must count entropy for black holes. Well, he was more interested in quantitatively knowing how much entropy, how many bits of information were hidden in a black hole. And here was his argument. I'm going to show you his argument. It's very beautiful. There's a little bit of mathematics to it. I'm not going to do the mathematics. He said, let's start with a very tiny black hole. Very, very small black hole, have very little information in it. A black hole as big as a proton, let's say, no bigger. And now let's start making that black hole bigger by dropping things into it. And we're going to drop things in one bit of information at a time. How do you drop a bit of information into a black hole? You drop in a single elementary particle, a photon. So he said, let's drop in one by one bits of information. The only information that's there in an elementary particle is either it's there or it's not there. It's like a dot or a dash. It's either there or it's not there. If we drop a particle into a black hole, there must be a particle in the black hole. We may not know where it is, but that's a piece of information. What happens when we drop the bit of information in? The black hole grows a little bit. It absorbs the energy of the photon, grows a little bit, because the more energy that it has, the bigger it is. And then we throw in another one, and the black hole grows, and so on and so forth, until we build up ourselves the black hole that we're interested in. Well, what Bekenstein discovered was quite remarkable. When he sat down, did the mathematical calculations, he discovered that the number of bits of information that could be in a black hole, if you think about it for a minute before I address this, how many bits of information are in a tub full of water? The answer is the amount of water that's there, roughly. And the amount of water is proportional to the volume of water in the bathtub. Up until Bekenstein, it was always the case that the amount of information, the information in the air in this room, is proportional to the volume. Why? Because the number of particles is proportional to the volume. But what Bekenstein found when he did his little thought experiment of throwing in bits is the black hole grew in such a way that the number of bits that could be inside the black hole was proportional to the area of the black hole. The area of the black hole in some tiny unit called the Planck unit. What did this say? This said that somehow the interior of the black hole had nothing in it, only the horizon of the black hole. The horizon of the black hole was storing all the information, and it was storing it very, very much as if the black hole horizon was made out of bits of information which were impenetrable, and each time you put another bit in, it increased the area of the black hole a little bit. That was Bekenstein's resolution of the second law of thermodynamics. Throw things into a black hole, they appear on the horizon as bits of information, bits of entropy, and as you fill up the black hole, it simply grows, its horizon gets bigger and bigger. But the surprising thing was this new idea that entropy somehow resided only on the surface. It was as though all of the information in this room was on the boundaries of the room, not in the interior of the room. And this was very, very confusing. Well, that raises a question. I'm going to take a little time out to answer a particular question. What are the hidden microscopic structures, these little bits that make up the horizon of a black hole, that make up the entropy of a black hole? I'm going to tell you very quickly now that string theorists over the last decade have put together a theory of what is on the surface of a black hole. It began with the basic ideas of string theory that elementary particles are little tiny strings, a weird idea, but let's accept it. Little tiny strings, no bigger than the Planck scale, vibrating and doing whatever they do. But if you heat them up, how can you heat them up? You can put them in a frying pan and heat the frying pan. Well, that doesn't do very much. But if you collide them together at enormous energies, you can heat them up. And when you heat them up, they grow. They get more tangled. They expand. They expand. The string grows, more energy, more string. And eventually, they form huge tangles of string when you pump enough energy into them. Well, those huge tangles of string gravitate. The parts of it pull themselves together by gravity, and that forms a black hole. What we now believe, at least those of us who have some confidence in the ideas of string theory, is that a black hole is nothing but a huge tangle of string which has been pulled together by gravity. But on the surface of that huge tangle of string, little bits of string carry the information that is on the horizon of the black hole. That's what is now believed about black holes, that their surface is a tangled mess of hot bits of information. And they are very hot. I won't have time to tell you why they are very hot. But if you were to lower a thermometer down to the surface of a black hole, you would discover this hot bath of bits of information. Well, that is a bit confusing. The first picture I gave you of a black hole is that it was nothing but a point of no return, or a black hole horizon, that the horizon was nothing but a point of no return which you could freely fall past. Alice would freely fall past it. Nothing much would happen to her. She would pass the horizon of the black hole, be trapped, she can't get out, but she would feel no pain as she passed the horizon of the black hole. That was one picture of the black hole horizon, a harmless point of no return. But now, let's think about Alice falling through the black hole. According to that picture, Alice would fall into a black hole, and this theory, that it's just a point of no return, says that she would see nothing out of the ordinary at the horizon. She would happily sail through, right through the point of no return, cool as a cucumber, nothing would happen to her. On the other hand, the other picture is that the horizon of the black hole is a terribly hot bit, soup of bits, a tangle of string, a soup of bits, and hot. How hot? If you were to lower a thermometer down to the surface of a black hole and then retrieve it to see how hot it got, the closer it got to the surface of the black hole, surface means the horizon, the closer it gets to the horizon, the hotter it would be. It would heat up to a million, billion, billion, billion degrees. Something's funny here. We have two distinct pictures. Which is true? Is it a harmless point of no return, the horizon? Or is it a hot soup of bits where Alice would get destroyed, destroyed by the heat? Here's two pictures. The two pictures are Alice falling freely through the horizon of the black hole, nothing happening to her. That was one picture. And incidentally, this is the picture that followed from a naive application of general theory of relativity. The other picture says that when she got to the horizon, she would encounter a super hot soup of bits at the horizon. She would be cooked, thermalized, and then radiated back out as photons. Here she is, falling into the black hole. The black hole is surrounded by this hot soup of bits. As she falls in, she encounters it. It's a million, billion, 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 billion degrees. What happens to her? She gets evaporated, ionized, turned into photons, and radiated back out. Obviously, both of these things cannot be right. Does Alice fall safely through the horizon, or is she thermalized and eventually radiated back out in the form of scrambled photons? That was the big controversy that physicists were dealing with when they entered into this black hole war. Well, what is the answer? The answer is that both are true. How on earth can both be true? Either Alice is destroyed at the horizon or she's not destroyed at the horizon. It stands to reason two things which are contradictory can't both be true. And yet, the more we thought about it, the more we came to the conclusion that both things are true. How can that possibly be? Well, the answer has to do with what you can really measure about a system. There are all kinds of circumstances in physics where apparently contradictory things are both true. I'll give you an example. If a light bulb over there goes off, and a light bulb over there goes off, one and then the other, or the other and then the one of them must go off first, right? It stands to reason. If that one goes off first, then that one could not go off first. If that one goes off first, then that one could not go off first. But we've learned from Einstein that there is no definite answer to the question of which one goes off first. It depends on how the observer is moving. If the observer is moving fast, you will see that one goes off first. If he's moving in the other direction, you'll see that one go off first. And so there is a relativity to observations. It's not necessarily the case that two apparently contradictory things can't both be true. It depends on how the observation is done. Well, what we learned is that, in fact, both things were true. Here's Bob. Bob stands outside the black hole. He watches Alice fall into the black hole. Alice falls into the black hole, and she says, when she passes the horizon, she says, I'm okay, I've just passed the point of no return. I haven't gotten to the singularity yet. I'm perfectly healthy. I haven't been cooked. I haven't been heated up. The problem is, she can never communicate that information to Bob. If the information can never be communicated to Bob, then Bob has no way of knowing that Alice is okay. Bob sees, on the other hand, radiation coming out from the black hole. He counts up all that radiation, and he discovers there's one bit for each bit of Alice that fell into the black hole. He finds Alice having been cooked and radiated and sent back out. But is there a contradiction? Not in the strict sense of the word, because Alice can never communicate that information to Bob, and so there's no observable contradiction. That idea, believe it or not, has infected itself into physics, and it is now generally accepted that both views are true. Alice falling into the black hole encounters nothing crazy at the horizon, and is perfectly safe until she gets to the singularity. Bob, watching the whole thing, discovers Alice being disassembled, cooked, radiated, and sent back out as photons. So the lesson is that objectivity is not really what we thought it was. The idea of where information is, how things behave, is relative. It's another example of relativity in action. But wait a minute, you say. What happens if Bob looks at Alice not after she crosses the horizon, but just as she's about to cross the horizon? I told you a moment ago that near the horizon, if you drop the thermometer down, not through the horizon, but near the horizon, that it's extremely hot. Bob doesn't have to wait until Alice falls through the horizon to ask her, Alice, are you okay? Or he can shine a light on Alice and try to make an image of Alice and see if Alice is okay. Well, it turns out that it's very interesting. In order for Bob to take a good look at Alice, as she gets very, very close to the horizon, he needs to use photons of very small wavelength. If he wants to resolve, the same way you need a telescope of short wavelength to resolve a small object, in order to resolve Alice as she gets closer and closer to the horizon, she has to be illuminated with very short wavelength photons. Short wavelength photons mean very high energy photons. The lesson is, in the process of trying to find out if Alice is okay, he has to hit her with incredibly high energy photons, which, in the process of looking at her, will cook her. Just the thing that Bob wanted to show didn't happen by observing Alice, he causes to happen by observing Alice. And so what we found over the years is that there really is no contradiction. If Bob chooses to look at Alice, he will find that she does get cooked at the horizon. If he leaves her alone, he will still think she gets cooked at the horizon because he will discover all this radiation coming out. But Alice will pass smoothly through, feel no pain, and in her frame of reference, relative to her frame of reference, she will discover nothing unusual. That is the ultimate upshot of this confusion that was raised by Hawking in the first place, but it's a big deal. It's not a small deal. It meant we were thinking completely wrong about information, how it was stored, where it is found, how relative it is, and how objective a piece of information is. The whole subject got turned on its head. Now, an even more startling conclusion that came out of this series of investigations: the world is like the ghostly three-dimensional illusion cast by a hologram. That sounds very weird. Most of you know what a hologram is, but before I get to holograms, let me explain something about information and how it's stored ordinarily. This is supposed to be a picture of a library. In fact, it was supposed to be the picture of the library in Alexandria. It's my artist's rendition of it. It was known to be about, I think, 200 feet by 40 feet by some number of feet in this direction here. Question? I thought I heard a question. All right. This is the library in Alexandria, reconstructed according to my own imagination, and it had a certain size. We could ask, how much information could be stored in that library? Well, it turned out that about 1 trillion bits of information was stored in the library in Alexandria in the form of scrolls. 1 trillion bits of information. In other words, information could be turned into a billion dots and dashes. 1 billion is not very much. Why couldn't you store more information? Well, you certainly could. You could shrink it down from scrolls to books, or from books to microfiche, or you could squeeze it down onto digital chips and get a lot more information in there. But what's the maximum amount of information that you could put into a library this big? And the answer most physicists always thought was that there was a limit. You could not make a bit of information smaller than 1 cubic Planck length. If that's the case, you can calculate the number, the volume of this library in Planck units, and you would discover that it was about 10 to the 108th. That's a huge number. That's more than all the particles in the known universe, that it could hold 10 to the 108th bits of information. A huge amount could be stored in there. Well, what if the owner of this library passed a law, a crazy law? The crazy law is that you're not allowed to put any information in the interior of the library. All you're allowed to do is decorate the outside of the laboratory with writing with information. Arbitrarily small, you can make your letters no bigger than the Planck scale, but then how much information can the library store if it's only allowed to have its bits of information coating the surface of the library? A lot less. It's proportional to the area of the surface of the library. Only 10 to the 72. Well, that doesn't sound like a big difference, 10 to the 72 and 10 to the 108, but if you're familiar with thinking about numbers, 10 to the 108 is vastly, vastly bigger than 10 to the 72, and so you lose a lot of possibility of storing information if you can only put it on the outside. Well, it's a strange law of nature, and it is now believed by everybody who works in theoretical physics to be a law of nature, that you can never put more information into a library or into a volume of space than the amount that you can store on the boundary. It is as if all that you could never have more information in this room than the amount that you could store on the boundaries of this room if you reduced it down to little pixels, pixels on the boundary of the room, and that seems extremely counterintuitive, extremely so. To illustrate the difference between information being stored in volume and being stored on surface area, I just invite you to look at this picture here. This picture has a Rembrandt's anatomy lesson, and it sure looks three-dimensional. It looks like there's all kinds of three-dimensional information here. The dead man here looks foreshortened. He looks more or less as if you're looking at him from the feet on because he's so short. There's information behind this guy's head here in a scroll. Everything looks very three-dimensional, but of course it's an illusion. There is no three-dimensional information here. You cannot tell whether this dead man is foreshortened or whether he's just short. You cannot walk around the picture and see what's on the scroll behind the tall man's head here. In fact, you can't even tell whether this is a real three-dimensional object or whether it's just a flat painting of a three-dimensional object. It doesn't really have three-dimensional information. The three-dimensionality of it is an illusion. It's in your head. Information is being stored. Since this was actually a photograph taken with a digital camera, that information is stored in pixels, two-dimensional array of pixels. Obviously, that two-dimensional array of pixels cannot really store three-dimensional information. It's an illusion. Can you store three-dimensional information? Sure. You can store it by storing it three-dimensionally. Instead of pixels, you store it in the form of voxels. Voxels mean three-dimensional arrays of dots and dashes. In other words, a three-dimensional tic-tac-toe puzzle. If you allowed yourself to store information, bits of information, on a three-dimensional lattice like this, of course you could store all the information in a three-dimensional picture. But obviously you can't store three-dimensional information on two-dimensional pixels. Well, that's not actually true. Holograms are examples of the storage of three-dimensional information on a two-dimensional film. A hologram is a two-dimensional film. This is a picture of the film on which a three-dimensional figure is depicted by the method of holograms. What do you see? You see a scramble of meaningless scratches and dots and dashes. Impossible to decipher what this is a picture of. Completely scrambled. But it is two-dimensional. However, if you know the rule, and in this case the rule is simple, you just shine light on the hologram, it will create a three-dimensional image, and it's not like Rembrandt's painting of the anatomy lesson. You can, if I was any good at making videos, I would have you turn this thing around and look at the clown from the back. But a hologram is a picture like this, stored on a two-dimensional film, that allows you to reconstruct a full three-dimensional image that you can walk around, look at it from the back, look at it from the front, And in principle, you could even make a hologram of the interior of his head, his brain, and see every bit of information that's going on inside the clown's head, but stored on the two-dimensional hologram. So it's not really true that you cannot store three-dimensional images in two dimensions. Well, one of the things we found out, and I'm going to explain to you how we found it out, was that in a certain mathematical sense, the entire universe, the entire world, can be thought of as a hologram out on the boundaries of space at the very edges of the universe, 10 billion light years away, a kind of two-dimensional holographic image encodes all of the information that's there, filling up the universe in the form of stars, planets, people, and everything else. This is one of the weirdest and most unintuitive extrapolations in physics since quantum mechanics. It is truly weird, but it has taken over physics and it has become a principle of physics. It's called the holographic principle. I'm going to show you how we came to that. We came to that by thinking about black holes. So, how did we ever come to such an unintuitive thing? Let's start with a box. I have made a round box, a round spherical box, because it's easier to think about a round sphere. A box is just a thing that could contain something. It's not even necessary that the walls of the box are real, just a region of space. And let's put some information into that box. That information could be in the form of matter. Here it's cheese and wine. It could be in the form of a bunch of a gas of elementary particles. It could be vapor. It could be anything. It could just be dots and dashes on a page in a book that you could throw in here. Let's put some information in there inside a certain volume, and that volume is bounded by a certain area. Now let's take that information. This is the kind of experiments, when you can't do real experiments, you do thought experiments. Here is the thought experiment. One would love to be able to do this, but it's quite impossible technologically. Let's surround that stuff by a shell of material. It could be steel, or it could just be light coming in. A shell of material that's been accelerated inward so that it's about to collapse. Let's make that shell of material just massive enough so that when it gets to the boundary over here, it creates a black hole. Everybody who thinks about black holes will admit that this is a possibility, that you can add to a system an amount of material, squeeze it down until what's left over is a black hole. Well, if no information is lost during this process, and remember, it's a basic law of physics that information can never really be lost. If no information is lost, then the initial information in there, in the wine, the cheese, and the particles, must be less than the amount of information in the black hole. But we know how much information is in the black hole. It's proportional to the surface area. That's what Bekenstein taught us. One bit of information for each square Planck area on the black hole. What does that tell us? That tells us that there could never have been more information in this region than what can be stored on the surface. You cannot store more information in a region than what can be on the surface in the form of one bit per Planck area. Why? Because you can always shrink it down into a black hole, and then the amount of information is known, and if none can be lost, then there must have been less information to begin with. If there's less information, or at least no more information, than can be stored on the surface, that's as good as saying that everything that was in there can be represented by information on the boundary of the black hole. Another way to say it is the boundary of the black hole, the horizon, is a hologram. It is, in fact, a hologram. There are two reconstructions of the hologram. One reconstruction Alice sees when she jumps into it. When she jumps into it, she sees the images that are reconstructed from the hologram. Planets, stars, even her own head and her arms when she gets inside the black hole. But on the other hand, Bob, watching from the outside, sees the boundary of the black hole as a collection of bits, in other words, like a holographic film. That holographic film eventually evaporates, just like any real film. A real film, if left out in the warm air, will eventually evaporate, and that's the Hawking evaporation process. So we have a very, very surprising conclusion. It's called the holographic principle. The world, what did I write? The world is pixelated, not voxelated. In other words, this entire room, everything in it, is really represented mathematically by a theory on the boundary, which is very much like a hologram. That idea has now become a central pillar of physics. It is not any longer a conjecture. It is now a mathematical reality that the universe, the entire universe, can be represented as a boundary theory with everything on the boundary, where the boundary is out near the horizon of the universe. Well, this is something that, of course, has never and probably will never be directly experimentally tested. It involves things which are far too small, Planck area size things, far too small. But it is through the extraordinary ingenuity of physicists, not just string theorists, that the holographic principle is no longer a wild speculation, but today it has become a basic principle and a mathematical tool of theoretical physics. Its influence is being felt from everything from nuclear physics to cosmology. For more, you have to read my book. But what's the final conclusion? Nobody knows the final conclusion, but we no longer disagree. Are the bits of information that fall into a black hole completely lost to the outside world? No. They form a kind of hologram on the boundary of the black hole, which eventually evaporates with every bit being accounted for. We now all agree. Nobody disagrees anymore. Stephen, myself, Etuft. In fact, here is an image of a bet that was made about it, not between myself and Stephen, but between a physicist named Don Page. And you can read it. It will not say anything that you will recognize, but the content of it is it true that information will always be re-emitted from the black hole, or will it be lost, as Stephen Hawking said? Will it come out, as Susskind and Etuft said, or will it be lost to the interior of the black hole, never to come out? That's the question, and here is Stephen's concession that he lost the bet. And here's his thumbprint. No, that really is. That really is his thumbprint. All right. Well, it sounds crazy. It sounds completely insane. The world is a hologram. It came out of a clash of principles. It came out of the apparent impossibility of putting together gravity with quantum mechanics. I like to quote at this point Sherlock Holmes, when he said, when you have eliminated all that is impossible, whatever remains must be the truth, no matter how improbable. Thank you.
Okay. I'm jet-lagged, so I had to sleep, but at the beginning, I didn't sleep yet, so you said something about the information being encoded in the Morse code, and to me, that's sort of arbitrary, about 65 bits. That information about King Canute seems to have just one bit of information, either he has the words or not, and that's one bit. Why is it 65?
Yeah, well, of course, part of the problem is we use information in a colloquial sense, and we use it also in a very technical sense. In the technical sense, saying that somebody has warts on his chin is not really a collection of bits of information. Bits of information do really correspond to physical realities and how many yeses and nos you would have to answer in order to state what the physical configuration of a system is. So for example, we could divide this room up into lots of little voxels. Let's forget whether it's pixelated or voxelated. Divide it up into lots of little pixels, and for simplicity, let's suppose there's only one kind of elementary particle, let's call it an electron, and then the only thing that we could ask is, in each little voxel, is there or is there not an electron? If we knew in every voxel whether there was or was not an electron, we would know everything about this room. How many yeses and no questions are there to answer, to know everything about this room? Well, it's the number of voxels. So that's the technical of idea information. How many yes-no decisions, or how many yes-no statements do you have to make in order to say everything that can be known about this room? Perhaps King Canute's chin was not really a good example. I only used it to illustrate the idea of dots and dashes.
Hi, my name is Venkat. I have a couple of questions. So the classic definition of a black hole as something from which nothing can escape, not even light, is that not right?
I'm having a little trouble hearing. Did you hear it?
Sure, I'll come up. Yeah.
The question is the classic definition of a black hole where nothing can escape, not even light, not correct?
No, it is correct. The point from which nothing can escape, not even light. Yes, that is correct.
That's correct, but we have stuff coming out of the black hole, right? Like Hawking radiation.
No. Okay, well, good. Is it coming out of the black hole, or is it coming off from just above the surface of the black hole? So one way of thinking about it is that the material that falls onto a black hole never really falls into the interior of the black hole. When watched from the outside, it takes an infinite amount of time for anything to actually fall through the black hole. So one way to say it is nothing ever really does fall into the black hole. It just collects on the surface, heating it up in thinner and thinner layers as time goes on. And the radiation that comes off from the surface of the black hole is really coming off from a thin little layer just above it. Or at least that's what Bob says, watching it from the outside. Alice, she seems to think that she's fallen right through the surface of the black hole. That is what the puzzle is all about. So you could say, on the one hand, when watched from the outside, nothing ever does get into the black hole. On the other hand, falling through with Alice, you would swear that she fell through unharmed through the black hole. That is, and which is correct? Both are correct. And we are going to have to live with that for a long time.
Thank you.
Is this evolution and understanding a step in the direction of the grand unified theory?
Well, I think these questions, in order to experimentally access them, would require, let's call them microscopes, which could see down to scales, size scales, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters on a side. The questions that are taking place in particle physics at the present time, questions about grand unification and so forth, are much more coarse-grained than that. They're on scales thousands of times larger than that. So, no, questions about the sorts of questions which we can hope will be answered, let's say, at the LHC, won't directly bear on this. Somewhat indirectly, they will. If it turns out that string theory is a good description of what happens at the LHC, then it will tell us that perhaps string theory is a good description of a black hole. But the connection is, at best, a distant one. I wish it were otherwise.
Thank you for the lecture. How certain are we on the actual physics and existence of black holes. I mean, people were quite certain of classical mechanics before Einstein and, you know, like some observations that were made. So how certain are we that, you know, like there's no some unbeknown to us physics at that energy scale?
I would say pretty certain. From a theoretical point of view, if you believe the general theory of relativity, there seems to be no escape from the idea that matter will collapse, stars will collapse into black holes. That's a theoretical statement. From an observational statement, we certainly see things out there which look remarkably like black holes are supposed to look. I don't think you can ever know without getting up much closer to them whether they really behave exactly like black holes. But it certainly looks very compelling to most astronomers that the things that we see in the centers of galaxies are giant, massive black holes, that collapsed stars, when the star is bigger than maybe 10 times the mass of the sun, that those collapsed stars are also black holes. So is there any room at all for saying maybe black holes don't exist? Yeah, I suppose there's some tiny, tiny room. But I think I would have to say that the smart money in both theoretical physics, astronomy, and cosmology would say that black holes are very definitely real. It would be more radical, much more radical, to say that they don't exist than to say that they do exist. That's the way I judge it. How radical is it to say they do exist? Not radical at all by now. How radical is it to say that black holes don't exist? You'd have to completely change the theory, and you'd have to blame the observations on something that we have no idea what it could be. So it'd be very radical to say they don't exist.
Is there a relationship between the dark force and black hole?
Dark matter.
Dark
matter or dark energy?
Dark energy and black hole?
Dark energy.
Yeah.
There is a funny relationship. I showed you how to think about a black hole as a drain hole, where as the water is moving in at some point that exceeds the speed of light or sound or whatever it happens to be. Well, dark energy causes the universe to expand more rapidly than it would otherwise. It's called the accelerated expansion of the universe. Because of it, if you go out to a far enough distance, the universe will be receding, or matter will be receding away from you with greater than the speed of light. It is as though the universe was a lake with an outward flow. And as you go further and further out, the flow gets faster and faster. If you go out far enough, the water, let's call it water, the water will be flowing away from the center with faster than the speed of, it could be sound in the case of the fish's pool. In that case, anything that's out past that point is beyond a cosmic horizon. We are in the interior, not in the interior of a black hole, but we are in the interior of a cosmic horizon, and we are surrounded by a cosmic horizon. We can throw things, what things? Stars, planets, and so forth. When they pass outside the cosmic horizon, they're lost to us, they're gone. And it is very, very much like when things fall into a black hole, as seen from the outside. What we see from the inside is almost like an inside-out black hole. So yeah, there is a connection between the dark energy, the accelerated expansion of the universe, and the existence of cosmic horizons, which surround us rather than we surrounding the horizon of a black hole.
Hello. How about dark matter? And is dark matter black hole?
It doesn't seem so. First of all, let me just explain to the audience the difference between dark matter and dark energy. Dark energy is somewhat weirder, and it really corresponds to a universal repulsion, gravitational repulsion between things, which is pushing the universe apart at an accelerated rate. It's not formed from particles. It's not ordinary matter of any kind. It's not even particles of unknown type. It's not particles, period. It's a form of energy which is there in empty space. Dark matter, by contrast, is a totally different thing. It's simply, most likely, it is simply elementary particles which are electrically uncharged and therefore don't emit electromagnetic radiation. Therefore, they are invisible. What kind of particles? Well, they're not neutrons, we know that. Neutrons don't live very long. They're electrically neutral. We know they're not neutrons because neutrons have a lifetime of about 12 minutes, and they've been out there for a long time. They're not neutrinos for another reason. So most likely, they are a form of particle that we have not yet discovered in the laboratory. It's a pretty safe bet. All physicists who work on elementary particle physics do not believe, they believe that we have not discovered the entire zoo of elementary particles. Almost every physicist has 10,000 new particles that he wants to postulate. So there's plenty of room in physics for many, many more kinds of particles that we haven't seen yet. Most likely, and when I say most likely, I'm judging basically on the number of physicists who believe in a certain thing, I being one of them. Most physicists believe that dark matter is simply elementary particles that we haven't discovered yet, and they're out there. They're out there, they surround galaxies, they form the halos of galaxies, but they're really not in any very deep and significant difference, different way, different than ordinary particles. So dark matter, I think, is less of a mystery than sometimes it's made out to be in the public press.
Hi, you said that we can only get two dimensions worth of Planck length, so we can't get the volume of it.
The amount of information that can be stored in a region.
So that's like from a two-dimensional to a three-dimensional, but there's 11 dimensions. So are you saying that these two dimensions create 11 dimensions as well as everything including light and gravity in the universe?
There are three obvious dimensions of space, that way, and that way. I can never find the other seven of them, but they're there. They're tiny. If you really wanted to think about the world the way string theorists think about it as 11-dimensional with some tiny dimensions, I think you could probably say that in that 11-dimensional world, that all information is stored on 10-dimensional boundaries. But from the gross macroscopic viewpoint, it would translate into our world saying that that the three-dimensional world becomes two-dimensional. You know what? I'm going to refer you to my book, The Black Hole War, for the answer to that question.
Over there.
I just have one quick question. So if the universe is to be viewed as a... Yeah, okay. If the universe is to be viewed as a hologram with the cosmic sort of background as being the edge, what is the light source that illuminates the hologram that we all see?
Well, yeah.
Because there's nothing.
No.
That's
right. Right. I don't think there's a light source in that sense.
Yeah.
What you can say about the hologram stores three-dimensional information even if you don't illuminate it. If you don't illuminate it, that three-dimensional information is stored. Illuminating it is just a way of seeing it, What is believed is that the mathematical description of the three-dimensional world is equivalent to a mathematical description of a two-dimensional surface far away. Now, the faraway world is as scrambled as a hologram. In other words, if you could reconstruct that two-dimensional hologram at the edges of the universe, you wouldn't recognize, if you looked at it through a microscope, you wouldn't recognize the ordinary things in the world unless you knew the special code for reconstructing. Fortunately, in the case of ordinary holograms, the code is pretty easy. There's a mathematical code that you could decipher. If I showed you the hologram and I told you what mathematical process to do, you could reconstruct what it was a picture of. But fortunately, it's a simpler way. You just shine some light on it. I wish I knew how to do the same thing. There is no analog for how to shine light on the cosmic hologram and reconstruct the world in this sense. It's a mathematical equivalence.
Okay.
say that only the people standing now are going to have their questions, okay?
I don't decide who raises questions. Oh. I can't even see them from
no,
here.
No, can you announce that because they can't hear me? Just
oh, only people who stand can ask questions.
Only people who are standing now.
I don't make the rules.
All right.
So, I'm willing to answer questions.
This is taking it from Alice's point of view, inside the black hole,
yes.
Not from Bob's.
Yes.
There was a book written, it was about 20 years ago, by a fellow named Kaufman. Not that well known, I don't remember his first name.
Stuart Kaufman?
Kaufman, K-A-U-F-F-M-A-N, Kaufman.
William Kaufman. Yeah, I don't know. No.
And the subject matter of his book was that if you got a black hole that was the right size and the right spin, a spaceship could go into this black hole or skip off of the black hole, I'm not sure which, and end up very fast in another part of the universe.
Yeah, this is a sort of urban myth that that black holes can be tunnels to other places in the universe. And the origin of the myth, the urban myth, is actually the mathematics of Einstein and Rosen, who constructed a mathematical solution of a black hole where the black hole consisted of sort of two pieces, two mouths. A black hole is like a mouth, right, that sucks things in. And two mouths connected by an alimentary tract. one of them here and the other one very, very far away. It was a legitimate mathematical solution of Einstein's equations, but there were two things wrong with it. First of all, the tunnel that it's called an Einstein-Rosen bridge. The Einstein-Rosen bridge is a kind of tunnel, but at first it's closed, no tunnel opening up. The tunnel opens up and then closes again very quickly. And it always does it in such a way that nothing, including light, can pass through. They're called non-traversable wormholes. You can't get through, it just doesn't stay open long enough. But the other fact is that what Einstein and Rosen were talking about were very idealized black holes that had been there for an eternity into the past. Our universe was not like this for an eternity into the past. It originated in the Big Bang. Black holes can't be older than the Big Bang. Black holes, which were created by, let's say, the collapse of stars or the collapse of galaxies or anything like that, are not bridges from one place to another. They're simply collapsed objects. So this is a, you know, it's a wonderful line for a science fiction story, black holes connecting connecting us to very, very different places. But there's no good physics reason to believe that idea. So I would say that's probably science fiction. Now, never say never.
In your example, you say Bob sees Alice getting thermalized and that the data, the information is then bounced or evaporated. Right off the surface of the
right
off the horizon.
Right.
And Alice at the same time experiences being in the hole but can't communicate that out. Does that mean that the theory transitioned from bits of information get lost to then no bits of information get lost, but it almost seems like it ends up being information gets duplicated.
Well, very good. Yes. There's a sense in which information gets duplicated. Information that falls in and information that's bounced off appears like duplicated information. Now, I don't know, your voice, from your voice, I don't recognize your voice, but I sort of recognize the voice of a physicist, am I right?
No, rocket scientist, sorry.
Rocket scientist. Are you a person who knows that it's a quantum no-no to duplicate information?
No, but it seems like a bad thing.
It is a bad thing. It is a bad thing. It's a theorem that information cannot be observably duplicated, but it's a very interesting thing that nobody can ever see the duplication of the information. Those that are behind the horizon see one thing, those that are outside the horizon see the other thing. And now you might ask, well, what happens if Bob, who's outside the horizon and collects this duplicated bit of information, which is the same as Alice's, what happens if he jumps into the black hole? Then can he compare his bit of information with Alice? And that's been studied. And it always turns out that before Bob can get a message from Alice about what her bit of information was, they both crash into the singularity and are killed. Really. So there seems to be a conspiracy that nobody ever detects this duplicated information. But one way of thinking about it is that the horizon of the black hole is made up out of a bunch of miniature Xerox machines, quantum Xerox machines, which duplicate the information and send some of it sailing through with Alice and send some of it back out with Bob.
Has this holographic principle led to doubts as to that a center of the black hole is actually a singularity?
No, not in the following sense. There are two ways you could make sense out of that question. First of all, you could ask, watch the black hole as it evaporates. And as it evaporates, it'll get smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually, at the last gasp, it will look like a singularity from the outside. Now, you have to take with a grain of salt what's meant by a singularity. A singularity just means something which is so dense and so extreme in its compression that all of the standard laws of physics break down and we can't think about it by the normal laws of physics. Something getting squashed to Planckian proportions, we can't follow it past there. We call that a singularity. We expect that if you could watch a black hole evaporate, then in its last gasp, it would look like a singularity. That's one statement. The other thing is we have no reason to believe that Alice won't get killed at the singularity when she goes in. As far as anybody can tell, Alice's fate, from her own point of view, from Bob's point of view, Alice's fate was she was cooked at the horizon. From Alice's point of view, she gets disassembled or whatever it is when she hits the singularity. So as far as we know, that has not changed, no.
Okay, back to the library.
Yes.
You spoke of you and I, supposing you and I are there, mm-hmm. and the library is absolutely full of information, 10 to the
108.
72nd, was it?
I don't know. Is it packed, the volume, or is it on the surface?
We're on the surface.
10 to the 72.
Okay, and you're outside, and you have access, you can see all that, you have access to all those bits.
Right.
I'm there too, but I'm inside the library.
Well.
And I'm looking at the same surface, and I see all 10 to the 72 bits.
Right.
Except I'm sitting in a chair, and I'm reading a book. Are the pages of the book blank?
Well, you might think of them as the holographic image, huh? You might think of them as the holographic image. We could imagine that somebody is shining coherent light on the outside of Ptolemy's library, and it's reconstructing itself into the pages of a book on the inside, and you're sitting, looking, and reading the pages of the book.
And I'm that image also. Well, you know,
But from my point of view outside, you're also plastered onto the outside of a... You and the book are plastered onto the outside of
But I personally have been losing bits of information for quite a while.
Yeah, I know. That's what happens after the age of about 50, I think.
I wanted to play the devil's advocate a little bit with your Sherlock Holmes idea that you eliminate the impossible, because I see some the things that you were describing as impossible, the idea that she's both burned to death and goes through without any problem.
Right.
That and you kind of, to me, it's kind of like weaseling around talking about different points of view, but to me, it is impossible to be thinking of both things being true at the same time. So that's my idea of impossible, so it's hard to go from there. Plus, and also with light, it's both the core, it's both a particle, and it's a wave both at the same time.
Yeah.
Now it's a wave,
I
don't see how an ordinary person can accept these things.
Yes. One of the themes of my book is exactly that, that our minds, our intellects were created by a process of evolution which was intended to give us the tools for ordinary experience, an ordinary range of parameters. We were not equipped by evolution to be able to think about motions near the speed of light. That's why relativity is so hard for us, because our minds weren't created for it. Our minds were not created to think about higher dimensional spaces. In fact, I often ask people this question in this kind of situation. How many of you can visualize four-dimensional space? Try to visualize it, not make a trick to think about it, but visualize it in the same sense that you can visualize a three-dimensional scene. Is there anybody here who thinks they can visualize four dimensions in the genuine sense? Good. We don't have to. We don't have to call the police. There's usually one wise guy who says he can do it, but apparently not here. How many people here think they can visualize a two-dimensional surface? I can't hear you.
Is it just Cartesian coordinates?
Well, for example, yes, but how about a curved surface? Can you visualize a curved surface? Okay. Now, admit the truth. When you look and think about that two-dimensional surface, don't you sort of see it as embedded in three dimensions? Can you really see that two-dimensional surface as two-dimensional without picturing it as some kind of surface embedded in three dimensions? I'll bet you can't. I'll bet you can't see a one-dimensional line without thinking of it as a one-dimensional line either in a plane or in three-dimensional space. The architecture of your brain was built for three dimensions. You can't get away from it. But there's nothing in mathematics which is better about three dimensions than four dimensions or two dimensions. It's just the limitations of your mental architecture. The same thing is true when it comes to things moving near the speed of light. The geometrical relationships between things which are moving near the speed of light are different than your mind was created for. You can't visualize them. The only way, how do you visualize four-dimensional things? Well, you don't visualize them, but it's very easy. You just add another letter to the alphabet, X, Y, Z, and W, and now you have your four-dimensional space. You use a mathematical crutch. The same is true for thinking about relativity. The same is true for thinking about waves and particles, or the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Our minds were simply not built to, the architecture of them was simply not built to be able to, I use the word grok them, to grok them. And so we are left with having to write equations and having to do mathematics. The same is true about the interior of black holes. They're another extreme environment, which is very, very far from what our minds were built for. Our minds were built for caves, walking into and out of caves, not falling into and out of black holes. The logic of walking into and out of a cave is extremely different than walking into and out of a black hole, and we're simply not equipped for it. So these things always come as surprises, and they come as surprises that I can't visualize any better than you, but we rewire ourselves, we retool ourselves with abstract mathematics, and then we try to explain it to a public audience using words that we inherit from ordinary experience, and that's where we get into trouble. When we try to explain these things using ordinary words, it's hard. I do the best I can. Apparently, sometimes I fail.
Thank you. My name is Caroline Zhen from China. Anyway, thank you for the talk.
You're welcome.
Now, I have two questions. The first one is, the black hole is such a unique thing to study because it's so different from the rest of the conventional physical world.
Right.
And it is in such an extreme condition that there's so much mystery about it. Now, is there any evidence to show that there are things actually more extreme than the black hole?
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, again, I would say never say never, because somebody will eventually cook up something either logically consistent or not logically consistent. But I think one can reasonably say that in certain senses, black holes are as extreme as it can be. They are as dense or as concentrated a form of information as possible. They are the heaviest things that can fit in a certain volume. So I think there's definitely a sense which they are very, very extremal. Can you think about things wilder than that? I don't know. My imagination is limited, but I don't know. But I think that, for me, I think of black holes as sort of the most extremal objects in the universe. But there is something interesting. You think of them as very exceptional, very unusual in the universe. Not the norm, but the very, very exotic. Well, if you take all of the bits of information that exist within the universe, then for every 10 billion bits of information, 999,999,999 of them are found on the surface of black holes. Only one bit out of 10 billion is an ordinary bit of the kind that you experience. All of the rest of them, 999,999,000 or 1,999 of them, are plastered on the surface of black holes. So in some sense, almost all information in the universe is in the form of black holes, and we are the exceptionally undense, rarefied, loosely knit together things.
May I have this second question? I think you will appreciate this one. talking about the two possibilities that you just illustrated, is it possible, because like now we not only prove that there is the existence of black holes, and also we found out there are more than, you know, hundreds of thousands of black holes out there just in our own galaxy. Now, is it possible that black holes are just banks for antimatters? Now we cannot find antimatters.
Banks for antimatter.
Yeah, banks for antimatters. It will help to serve, you know, answer the question.
Okay, so to me, a bank is a place that you can withdraw from as well as put things into. Now, that is not clear at the present time, but let us assume a bank is a place that you can withdraw from as well as deposit in. Let's take the case of protons. Protons have antiparticle partners which are called antiprotons. If you create a black hole out of protons, and that would be a black hole, protons and neutrons, made out of a star. An ordinary star collapses and forms a black hole. You create another black hole by using antimatter. You create what looks like an anti-black hole. Well, the anti-black hole and the black hole will be identical. There will be no difference between them at all. The stuff that comes out of each of these will basically be photons, and photons are their own antiparticle, so they're symmetric with respect to this particle-antiparticle distinction. So when stuff falls into a black hole, or when a black hole is made, let's say either by protons or antiprotons, that distinction gets lost. That distinction, that's not the same as information being lost, but the distinction between whether it was made of protons or antiprotons is lost. The black holes will be almost exactly the same, but in any case, you won't be able to tell the difference between them by withdrawing things out of the black hole and seeing whether they're protons or antiprotons. You'll get as many protons out of a black hole as antiprotons. And so in that sense, a black hole is not a good bank for depositing your protons if you expect to get as many out at the end as you put in.
Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Susskind. Thank you very much for coming out. I appreciate your lectures and follow your work. I'm still having trouble, like this last questioner, with the idea of relativity.
What was the question?
Sorry?
What was the question?
The question is, I was trying to think of another example than the two light bulbs, one over here, one over there. They both go, depends on
who's,
which
who's
one.
Who's talking?
Right here.
Okay,
right here.
Hi.
Yeah. I was trying to think of another example. Like if a bell went off on the other side of town here in Los Altos, a really loud bell, and then one went off 1 second later right next to my head, it would sound to me as if that went off first. Although we both know that objectively, the other bell went off first.
But
this is a two-part question, if I may. And the second part is this whole idea about two conflicting things being simultaneously true.
Well, they, of course, can't be really conflicting.
But I thought that was the whole point, was that they...
Well, they can't really be conflicting. I think the point is that we're suffering from a bad mental picture, not from an out-and-out contradiction. An out-and-out contradiction occurs when a single experiment can give rise to two conflicting answers, or when two conflicting answers can be compared. You take two thermometers and you stick them into the same tub of hot water, and one comes out saying 70 degrees and the other comes out saying 95 degrees, and you bring them together, the same person looks at them, and that person knows that there's something wrong. In this situation, there is no way to bring together the observations which apparently conflict. So I would really have to say it's a bad mental picture, the mental picture being that information is really stored in a concrete way in a certain place. It's apparently much more subtle than that, that where information is stored is relative in the same sense that the order of flashing of light bulbs is relative. It depends on the motion of the observer.
But only one can be objectively true.
No. The question of which light bulb went off first depends on who, on the observer.
Well, I thought it would depend on time.
I think this is the kind of discussion we should continue
after.
Okay. This is the last question.
Hi. You said something about black holes disintegrating over a certain amount of time.
Right.
And I was wondering, if that's really true, then where's the contradiction? Because don't you get that information back when they disintegrate? I mean, maybe...
Yes, but that's, of course, what Stephen said is not true. What Stephen said is information falls into the black hole past the horizon. Once it's past the horizon, it's trapped and it cannot come out.
Go ahead.
And then he said, then it evaporates. Now, it sure looked like he was right. When we did the mathematics and tried to follow the argument, it sure looked like he was right. But he was making an assumption, and the assumption is that there was an objective sense in which a bit of information is at a definite location in space. And that's what turned out to be wrong, that the notion that you can attribute a definite, precise location, independent of the state of the motion of the observer, to a particular bit of information. So he said it falls into the black hole in order to get out. You know what it's like? Here's what it's like. When the black hole evaporates, it's almost like the drain hole sealing itself up, okay? The drain hole... The pump that's pumping the water out is slowing down. When it slows down, the horizon shrinks, and eventually the pump stops, and the drain hole just ends. It's no longer there, and space is healed up. There's no more black hole there.
So when it evaporates, there's nothing that comes out of it. It ceases to exist.
That was the picture. That was the picture, and... On the basis of it, Stephen said that things that fall down into the drain and can't get back up because they would have to exceed the speed of light to get back up are simply lost down the drain.
Okay, I got it now. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's very, very hard to explain things which are wrong.
Let's thank Dr. Susskind for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.